Thank you again, Mr. Boss. I didn't say happy Sabbath, did I? Happy Sabbath. Well, you didn't say happy Sabbath either. Happy Sabbath. Hey! That's nice. What will happen next in Bible prophecy? Don't you find yourself asking that question after what happened in Paris? You see it spliced all over the TV and then down in Mali after that. You say, wow, where's it going to happen next? You hear all the chatter that's going on. U.S. State Department puts out a worldwide travel alert, never before issued that I know of, where it warns all Americans traveling internationally to be on extra alert, especially careful and staying away from certain areas, including the Vatican. Americans have been advised to stay away from the Vatican because they feel that it's going to be under attack. Many years ago, about 40, I did a series of Bible lectures in a town called Picture Butte, Alberta. And the town represents indeed what it sounds like. It was right up against the first chain of the Rocky Mountains as you're headed west on the Canadian prairies. I can remember many times approaching the city in the wintertime, and the wind would be blowing thousands of feet higher than I was, and I could see the snow shooting out hundreds of feet into the air from the top of the mountains. But down at ground level, at Picture Butte level, it was picturesque. It was nice not to be there, although I did go up through the Rockies as well. Well, when I did this lecture in town, we had quite a few people show up. There were a lot of subscribers to our magazine at the time. Two of them were brothers, and they showed a keen interest in the message of the truth that we were preaching. And they asked me after the lecture series to come and visit them at their home, which was a cattle ranch in the rolling foothills of the Rocky Mountains. Very beautiful setup, not an ostentatious home, but certainly a very beautiful setup. I did so several times over a course of, I don't remember, but several months. We wouldn't see them, you know, every week, but maybe every month or two I'd go out there to see them because they'd ask me to keep coming back. And we'd go through the pleasantries, not always pleasantries. The widowed mother was kind of hostile, but that's another story. But after we got through the greetings and so on, we always got around to this question. What will happen next in Bible prophecy? That's what they wanted to know. Okay, fine. You want to talk about Bible prophecy? It's a good subject. Many people come into the truth through that. We talked about what's going to happen next in Bible prophecy. What is going to happen next? Let's do that today. In order to answer that question, I'm actually going to give you five guidelines to keep in mind when either you have the question or somebody asks it of you. What is going to happen next in Bible prophecy? First, I'm going to take you back 76 years to November 1939. Some of you may remember 76 years ago. I'm not going to embarrass you to ask you if you do. Most of you do not. In November 1939, this magazine came out. I blew up the top of it, so most of you would be able to see it. Plain Truth Magazine, November 1939. It didn't come out every month at the time. It came out at different points. But November 1939, if you are historically minded, you will recall, was 2 months after what? After the declaration of war by Britain and France against Germany, the official beginning of World War II. It was, interestingly enough, when you think back, oh, you know, Mr. Herbert Armstrong doing this work, and he wrote this article, of course, and he did the hand graphics even there on the magazine. And you think, you know, Mr. Armstrong, you picture the white-haired man or whatever image you have in mind. Mr. Armstrong at that time had been a baptized member of the Church of God for only 12 years. How many of you have been a member for more than 12 years? He had been an ordained minister for only 8 years. Imagine yourself having the responsibility of declaring to the world what it means, what's going on in Europe, as Germany has gone into the Eastern European nations, and as Germany is threatening France and threatening Britain and talking about going to war, and finally Britain finds it necessary to declare war, what would be in your mind as Mussolini raises an army of 1.5 million men and is gearing up for going to war, although he hasn't declared which side he's going to go on? This was a very real situation. This is not just a small terrorist attack. I don't want to minimize what happened in Paris, where over 100 people died, but it wasn't 200 or 500 or 1,000 or 5,000. There were days in World War II when over 10,000 men died in a single battle. We just live in a different world where we're used to different statistics. At this time, the world was gearing up for World War II, and Mr. Armstrong wrote about it. I'd like to give you the highlight of some of this article. I've actually got the full article. If any of you would like to look at it afterwards, maybe you didn't know that you can actually get every Plain Truth ever published, every Tomorrow's World, every Good News, every World Tomorrow radio broadcast, television program. You can get them now on the Internet. It's not all a backyard fence. There's some good stuff there. Mr. Armstrong wrote, "What of the European war in the light of prophecy?" Well, what's going to happen next in prophecy? He wrote in the August number of the Plain Truth, "We told you, world war may come within 6 weeks." It did. But it did not come altogether in the way expected. Naturally, it was expected that once war began in Europe, it would be the last prophesied world war ending only in the Battle of Armageddon. And remember, World War II was only a few years after another major war that took millions and millions of lives. These three possibilities have been announced on the air to our listeners of the Radio Church of God. Apparently, that was the name of the radio program at the time, also the name of the church, Radio Church of God. Number one, Hitler would try to make peace with Britain and France after smashing Poland, a peace that would let him have Poland and dominate the Balkans. If this happened, the war would follow a little later. This possibility was tried and failed. This is after Hitler's famous so-called peace meeting with the British Prime Minister. Number two, Britain and France will go on and smash Hitlerism, perhaps with the help of the United States and Italy, either entering on the side of the Germans or remaining neutral, or, as astonishing as it may seem, again join with the Allies as she did in the first part of World War I and In this eventuality, the prophesied world war ending at Armageddon will come later. And this will pave the way for it. That is, if Italy either stays neutral or joins the United States and Britain, it'll still pave the way for the Battle of Armageddon. Third possibility, Italy will come to help her Axis partner, Germany. And it'll be a deadlock on the Western Front. The main sector of the battle will shift to the Mediterranean, especially Palestine and Egypt, and the war developing into the last of Bible prophecies. And, of course, the third possibility is mostly what happened. This is Herbert Armstrong as a young minister writing before all this happened, a real worldwide war taking place, and he forecast what would happen. Italy did eventually join Germany, and the war did go to North Africa and over into the countries of the Middle East. Of course, it did not end in the Battle of Armageddon. He wrote, "The most important factor for the prophetic student to watch is Italy in this war." Why Italy? Because Italy is the Roman power. Not Germany. Germany will precipitate events that lead directly to Armageddon. Briefly, the events prophesied leading to Armageddon are those in Daniel 11, verses 40 to 45. It mentions after conquering Ethiopia, the Roman ruler attacks and takes Palestine and Egypt in order to gain the Suez Canal. It doesn't say that in Daniel. The Suez Canal was added by Mr. Armstrong. Then he goes on to mention that the Great Tribulation would follow. The church would suffer. And then he wrote, "Mussolini will revive the Roman Empire by uniting 10 dictatorships in Europe." And he cited Revelation 17, which, of course, talks about 10 kings, giving their power to one king, or in essence electing one to be the major king, shortly before Armageddon. This probably will include the Balkan nations, that is part of the ten, and Spain. And the alliance is the beast of Revelation, Revelation 19. Russia, China, and Japan will all come in, probably at the very last, and Christ will come and end it all as the King of Kings. Well, there you have some things that are kind of interesting to hear going back. I could actually play his voice. That would have been interesting to do, to hear it in his voice. I will not try to imitate him. I've heard people do that, and I won't try to do that. But I want to draw lessons from, or guidelines from, how he handled this question that will help you handle the question. There are five of them. First guideline, number one, always view current events within the framework of Scripture. Yeah, that's a duh. You say, well, of course I do that. And you'll find, as you look at how people write about prophecy, that they don't always do that. And you'll find that it's very easy for your mind and mine to get outside of the framework of Scripture. Always view current events within the framework of Scripture. Mr. Armstrong had the biblical framework for the end time. He didn't have all of the facts correct. The framework was solid, and the framework is solid to this day. The succession of world empires he had in mind, the fact that there would be kings of the south and north he had in mind from Daniel. He had the identity of Israel's ancient descendants correct. He understood who they were and how they would figure in a crucial way at the end time. Put another way, think in terms of a chessboard. Mr. Armstrong had the full chessboard. And he had it completely filled with all of the pawns, the knights, the rooks, the bishops, the queens, and the kings. All the pieces were on the chessboard. But he did not know all the moves that were to take place on the chessboard. And he didn't know the names of all of the individuals who were represented by those pieces on the chessboard. But he had a good idea, an overview of how things will go. And he allowed for the fact that he didn't know all the details. You remember some of the things that I wrote to you? He said, if this happens, then that will happen. So he's allowing for things to go not necessarily the way he foresaw. Mr. Armstrong said many times in my presence, undoubtedly you heard it, perhaps in your presence as well, some of you older members, I am not a prophet. God does not reveal to me, you know, new things. I carry the message of the prophets. He never claimed to be a prophet. He wrote, it did not come in the way expected. He admitted openly it didn't happen the way that he thought it would. Lesson number two, don't hesitate to declare the truth, especially when things don't work out the way you thought those people on the chessboard were going to move. Mr. Armstrong did not hesitate. He continued to declare the truth very forcefully, as only Mr. Armstrong could, for nearly 47 years after he wrote that article in 1939, because he realized that the chessboard was valid and that the characters on there were valid and that the overview that he had was correct, even though the events did not conclude the way he thought they would in 1939 to 1945. And as you have read The Plain Truth and heard him preach over the years, he had other ideas of things that were going to happen and said this could happen and that could happen. And he kept suggesting ways that the people on the chessboard could move and who could be here and who could be there. We're doing that today. We're declaring the truth still. We're broadcasting it. As I mentioned earlier, you are by the way you live. But we are publicly talking about nations. We're talking about what happened in Paris. We're talking about what's happening in Syria. And I'm forever impressed as I read the Bible and I read about Ethiopia and I read about Libya and I read about Syria, which, by the way, in the Bible is often used to represent all of what we call the Levant. It means Syria, Iraq, southern Turkey, what is now Jordan, Israel, and part of Egypt. That's what Syria represented. But I read all of these names in the Bible and I open the newspaper or I look at the television news, the internet news, and what names do I read? These same nations. The Bible is truly up to date. And we do cover this with on LHT and in Discern magazine, and we soon will be doing so in videos. One of the best examples is in the current Discern magazine in Neil Hogberg's article, The Migrant Crisis. What does it mean? And he wrote about the flood of immigration coming into Europe. And he wrote this before the Paris attacks. But it fits in hand in glove with what happened in Paris. How was he able to do that? How was he able to project what might happen here and there? Because he had the chessboard in front of him. He had the parameters, just as Mr. Armstrong did. Some people become disillusioned with the truth if prophecy does not work out the way they had in mind. That's one reason why there aren't as many people in the Church of God in Canada or in this area as there were at one time. Their focus was on, such and such a time, this is going to happen. But it didn't happen, so I've lost confidence. I've lost belief in the one who was saying it. And that is a warning. We can never, and when it comes to prophecy, get our minds focused on this is exactly how this prophecy will come about or be fulfilled, except for those specific statements in the Bible, the parameters of the chessboard. Those we can have confidence in. But we should not focus on the lesser issues. The truth is, you cannot, I cannot, the church cannot give a detailed prediction of how or what is going to be fulfilled or when it's going to be fulfilled. The broad picture we can tell, but I can't tell you the next terrorist attack. I can't tell you an area of the world where it would be safe, or the place of safety could be, and you could be guaranteed that nothing would ever happen. We cannot do that. We do not have the gift of prophecy. I do suspect very strongly that God will give that gift to the two witnesses before the end of the age, and that these men will be able to say, tomorrow, at such and such a time, this will happen. Or they will say, this needs to happen, and immediately it will happen, especially as Revelation talks about if their lives are threatened, they'll be able to stop that threat and protect themselves immediately. Point number three, guideline number three, don't overstate the facts. It's one of the gravest dangers, one of the greatest temptations when you're dealing with the subject of prophecy. Oh, prophecy is so intriguing. It's so interesting. There's something appealing almost to the ego about being able to know what's going to happen in the future. And people find a certain level of entertainment in looking at prophetic things to see if they're going to work out that way. Mr. Armstrong did not overstate the facts in 1939. The world was going to war. The world was going to war. And not just the world, but Europe was going to war. And not just Europe, but a resurrection, as it were, of a Roman government had 1.5 million man standing army. Mussolini had this army. And these people did go into the nations of North Africa and in the Middle East that are mentioned in the Bible. He did not overstate the facts. He went through what Daniel covers. Let's turn in our Bibles to Daniel chapter 11. I am not going to go through every detail of horns and beasts and all of that kind of thing. If you have not familiarized yourself with these things, you certainly can, and I encourage you to do so, just so you will know the chessboard. You'll know the layout of what's going to happen and what's not going to happen. Daniel 11, verse 40. Oh, this has been looked at so many times in the last 2,000 years by people who've had access to the scriptures, and that's everybody today. At the time of the end, obviously just before Christ returns, the king of the south will attack him. Who's him? Who is the king of the south? And the king of the north, and who is that? Shall come against him, that's obviously the king of the south that the king of the north comes against, like a whirlwind. He'll come with chariots, horsemen, and with many ships, obviously a reference to war equipment, airplanes, jets, rockets, missiles these days, and infantrymen. You can never get away from that. And robots, undoubtedly you'll find these days, and many ships. He'll enter the countries and overwhelm and pass through. What countries? He'll also pass through the glorious land. That's obviously a reference to the promised land, so it would be the countries around the Middle East. Many countries will be overthrown. Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon will escape from him. He'll stretch out his hand against those countries. The land of Egypt will be included. He'll conquer that. It will not escape. He'll have power over the treasuries of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt. What's precious about Egypt? It's a rather poor country right now. I'm not really sure what would be precious about Egypt at the end time, but that's another question that has to be answered. Also, the Libyans and the Ethiopians will follow at his heels. And again, Libya is still prominent in the news. Ethiopia is, and especially just south of Ethiopia, where Sudan is, and you have Darfur and southern Sudan, and you have the Chinese involved, and you have the horsemen terrorists murdering literally millions of people and driving millions of people from their homes to south of Ethiopia, still going on now. This will happen, or these people will be involved in this end time event. But news from the east and the north will trouble this king. Therefore, he'll go out with great fury to destroy and annihilate many. He'll plant the tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain, between the Mediterranean Sea and the mountain chains of Israel that are on the eastern border of Israel. And yet shall he come to his end, and no one will help him. Christ will return and stop him. So this is the prophecy that goes right to the very end. Those are the facts. That is the chessboard. This will happen. Mr. Armstrong separated commentary most of the time on current events from the certainty of biblical prophecy. Now, some of the times he got carried away commenting about current events, but a lot of his writing and the radio broadcast was reporting on events from the war, and he would give commentary on the Bible. But most of the time he did what we're supposed to do, not overstating the facts. He would comment on what's going on where it's likely to end up, and then you can say with certainty it will end up as Daniel 11 verses 40 to 45 describe. Scripture is unbreakable. You cannot tip over this chessboard. You can't knock the pieces off. You cannot change what is going to happen. This will happen. But we, as we talk about Scripture, can muddle it up. We can explain it improperly. We can describe the chessboard inaccurately. We can name the figures on the chessboard inaccurately. And we have to take care not to overstate the facts. If we do, we lose credibility. Write a big blog, do a broadcast, say, this Paris attack is just the beginning of World War III, and inside of a month, you know, World War III is going to happen, and it doesn't happen, and who's going to listen to us then? Or we say the world is going to end by, you know, Pentecost next year, or something like that, and it doesn't happen. Who's going to listen to us then? It takes away from our credibility, and it damages the job that God put on our shoulders. He gave us a job to tell the message of the gospel of the kingdom of God, and included in that message is what we read in Daniel 11, verses 40 to 45. We are to preach about what is going to happen in the end. So, lesson number 4, use the facts accurately. It's the flip side of it. Using the facts accurately strengthens our credibility. I'm going to give you some facts that illustrate that, that in a way might seem like a pullback, but you'll see as I go through that. But it actually strengthens our credibility instead of detracting from it. What do the events that are going on in the world right now mean? Many people have said the United States is done for. Its economy is broken, and it is ruined. Its military power is no more. It can't project its military anywhere anymore. The U.S. doctrine of lead from behind means that its power is broken and it cannot dominate the world. What does the flood of immigration into Europe mean and the recent terrorist attacks? Is there a European army that's ready to attack in the Middle East? Some of you will say, well, yeah, the British are down there, or the Germans are sending down a couple of planes and some men. The French actually have Air Force that's flying down there. If you've seen a map of all the different air forces that are flying in and around Syria, it is just simply amazing, especially when you consider the drones that are flying besides the jet aircraft that are flying in the area. Is Europe ready to go down there and step right in with a heavy foot and take over the Middle East? What about the Catholic Church? Is the Catholic Church right now so powerful that it does dominate Europe and that it could control Europe in the way that the parameters of the chessboard say that it will in Daniel 7, Revelation chapter 13, 2 Thessalonians 2? What are the facts? I'm going to be going through parts of articles that you'll find on Life, Hope, and Truth, because we really do have the message out there. If you want to go on there, it may surprise you to realize now that we have approximately 2,000 articles on Life, Hope, and Truth. 2,000. So we cover a great deal of information, and prophecy is covered very well. In Daniel 11, let's go back a few verses to verse 35. In our article, Daniel 11, the most detailed prophecy in all the Bible, it mentions that verses 35 through 39 are somewhat controversial. It's hard to understand them. Do they relate to the time of 167 years before Christ, or right at the time of Christ, or the end time? Verse 35, some of those of understanding shall fall. Seems an obvious reference to people who are called to conversion and have spiritual understanding and who fall away from it. To refine them, purify them, and make them white until the time of the end, because it is still for the appointed time. And there is something that happens. Mr. Meeker covered this just a week ago, Friday, in the Bible study, and why things happen in the church and what happens to church members who are left behind when those who have been in the church go away. That has an effect on us. It does, in these words, purify us if we remain faithful. It tests us and tries us and tugs at the heart, tugs at the spirit, and grieves us. But it can and should make us stronger, and that is to continue through to the end. Then the king will do according to his own will. He shall exalt and magnify himself above every god and speak blasphemies against the God of gods. Now I'll interject and say, in the context here, this is talking about Antiochus Epiphanes. I'll explain more for those of you who aren't familiar with that in just a moment. But question, is it also talking about a man at the end of the age? Is it talking about one of these characters on the chessboard? He will prosper till the wrath has been accomplished, for what has been determined shall be done. He will regard neither the God of his fathers nor the desire of women. Some have thought, well, is that a reference to sexual preference? The commentaries say that it's most likely a reference to denying the Messiah. The people of the Middle East, especially the descendants of Israel, had looked for the Messiah, looked for Israel to give birth to the Messiah. And this individual disregards the Messiah, indeed calls himself God. And that's why he doesn't regard the God of his fathers. He regards himself as a deity. He doesn't regard any God. He exalts himself above them all. But in their place, he will honor a God of fortresses, and a God which his fathers did not know, he will honor with gold and silver and precious stones and pleasant things. At some point, he has to reach out beyond his realm of power and call on some other power to help him. He will acknowledge that foreign God. He will advance its glory, and he will cause them to rule over many and divide the land for gain. Continuing in the, reading from the article now, the reference to the time of the end offers a challenge in verse 35. Some understand it to refer to just before Christ's return. Others see it as the end of the Maccabean struggles. The Maccabees were the family that eventually got together enough resistance to Antiochus Epiphanes and overthrew him and retained the temple and the land of Israel for the Jews at the time. Some of the actions can be attributed to this Antiochus Epiphanes. Some seem to be prophecies of a beast power who will exist at the end of the age. The preceding verses in Daniel 11 represent extremely detailed prophecies that have been fulfilled exactly as they were revealed to Daniel. I'm not going to go into all of those, but if you have not read this, if you younger people have not made a study of this, read this article about Daniel 11 in prophecy. The accuracy of it is undeniable. God describes some engagements, some marriages, some palace intrigue, some assassinations that were fulfilled right down to the crossing of the T and the dotting of the I. And historians cannot deny it, and the commentaries go through it all in great detail, which makes this, you know, quite a powerful prophecy because it establishes the chessboard. Now, it's important to note, however, something very significant happened in 65 B.C. The time of Antiochus Epiphanes was 167. That's when he was overthrown. So about 100 years later, the king of the north and the king of the south were completely overthrown together. The Seleucid empire was overthrown. And for 2,000 years, there has not been a king of the north or the king of the south. It's just as if this chessboard was out here, the pieces were moving around, the game was being played, and the game stopped for 2,000 years. And then something critical happened in world history. 1948, United Nations recognized Israel as a nation. It offered the opportunity for a divided nation for Palestine and Israel. Palestinians rejected it. Israel accepted it. Israel became a nation, so there were Jews back in Israel, and there was an Israel, and there could again be someone to the north and someone to the south, and the prophecies could come alive again. In verses 40 to 45, we read the actions of a king of the north and a king of the south at the time of the end. The end time identities of these nations are yet to be determined. People will say, well, it's, you know, Germany is going to do this and Europe is going to do that. Well, we have to do as Mr. Armstrong did. Whenever you're working with prophecy, you have to say the way things look now, as I look at this prophetic grid here, this chessboard, it looks like this bishop could be so-and-so, and this pawn could be so-and-so, and this nation could come and go. But we do not know with certainty the names of the characters. We do know that there will be a king of the north, and there will be a king of the south. There is something else that we might know. If you turn to Revelation chapter 13, put this together with what I've already read to you from Daniel. Revelation 13 talks about two beasts. And again, you have to read all the background, and I'm assuming most of you know this, but the beast is a reference to the world-dominating power at the end of the age. It relates to Daniel in the sense that it is a resurrection of the Roman Empire. And it relates to Daniel in the sense that it is the king of the north. There are two beasts mentioned in Revelation 13. The first one is a political leader. I stood on the sand of the sea, verse 1 of chapter 13 of Revelation, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea. It had 7 heads and 10 horns. I'm not getting into all of that definition. On his head were 10 crowns, and on his heads a blasphemous name. Obviously, he is against God and represents an anti-God approach. It doesn't mean he's against religion. It means he's against the true God. And I don't know if we'll read this section, but it does say in Daniel 12, the wise will understand at the end of the age. It takes perception to recognize this. Now, the beast that I saw was like a leopard. His feet were like the feet of a bear. His mouth was like the mouth of a lion. And that is a combination of world empires. They're described in Daniel. So this last empire is like a combination of the greatest world empires down through history. And he gets his power from the dragon, symbolic of Satan, The dragon gives him his power, his throne, and his great authority. I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world marveled after the beast. So they worshiped the dragon who gave authority to the beast, and they said, who's like this beast? Who can defeat this? Now, there is an historical event when a resurrection of the Roman Empire collapsed, and it looked like it was defeated, and Justinian, I believe, was the emperor at the time, 554, wasn't it? You historians can tell me. And the Roman Church stepped in and lent its authority to the Roman Empire, and the Roman Empire then and thereafter became the Holy Roman Empire. So it's not against God. I mean, it's not against religion, but it is against the true God. Now read down a little further in Revelation 13 to verse 11, where there's another beast. I saw another beast coming up out of the earth. He had two horns and a lamb, and he spoke like the dragon. So his horns represent authority. Looking like a lamb, or horns like a lamb, means he takes on an image like Christ, presents himself as a representative of Christ or being Christ-like. He exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence and causes the earth and those who dwell on it to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. Question. Is it possible that at the end of the age, something happens in Europe where it looks like Europe is all powerful and all coming together and then collapses and then is rescued by the Roman Catholic Church, where history repeats itself? Prophecy is, we've often said prophecy is dual, but actually prophecy is layered. There are many fulfillments of prophecy or types of fulfillments of prophecy down through time. I don't know that that's going to happen, but after having just read that, let's go back again to Daniel chapter 11. Daniel 11, verse 40, at the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him. And we don't know who this him is. If it's an end-time prophecy that comes in the verses before, it's obviously not Antiochus Epiphanes. The king of the north will come against the king of the south like a whirlwind, come in defense of this king that is attacked by the king of the south. That's not what I wanted. I wanted to go back to verse 37 about this king. He doesn't regard the God of his fathers or the desire of women or any god. He exalts himself above them all. In their place, he honors a god of fortresses, a god which his fathers did not know, that he will honor with gold and silver and precious things. Could this be the Revelation 13 prophecy of the religious beast causing the world to worship the first beast? He reaches out to this other god. He will act against the strongest fortresses with a foreign god. He'll acknowledge and advance its glory. That's what I want to put together with Revelation 13, where the first beast seems to have a mortal wound, but the second beast, the religious beast, brings it back to life, and in the words of Daniel, advances its glory. Could that happen? Well, that is, I offer as a possibility. Next, I want to turn to Daniel chapter 7. Since we're in Daniel, go back, if you did turn there. I know some people just like to listen or doodle or do other things. Daniel chapter 7, verse 7. And we're coming down to a further refinement. We've been talking about this broad chessboard, and we're talking about kings and all that. We're going to refine this further. We're going to allow the Bible to refine it further. Daniel 7, verse 7. After this, this is after seeing Alexander's empire, the Persian Empire, and then it goes into four areas. Verse 6 talks about it going into four different directions. And you know how the Persian Empire broke up. And then there were kings of the east, west, north, and south for a while. After this, I saw a night vision, verse 7, and behold, a fourth beast, this dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong, had huge iron teeth. It was devouring and breaking in pieces and trampling the residue with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it. It had 10 horns. I considered those horns. Now, a comment before that. This is talking about the Roman approach that just destroyed everything in its path, destroyed all opposition. And it's prophetic of the end time beast who will destroy all things in its path. But as he's looking at this unusual vision and horns and everything, I considered the horns, and there was another one, a little one, smaller than the others. It came up before them, and there were 3 horns already there, and it knocked the 3 horns out. And then in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth speaking pompous words. This is a prophecy of the rise of that which made the Roman Empire the Holy Roman Empire. This is a prophecy of the rise of the Catholic Church when it destroyed and knocked out some weaker kings in the Roman Empire. And the Roman Catholic Church throughout history was extremely political. It had armies at its beck and call, and it ordered deaths, and it arranged alliances, etc., throughout the history of Europe. But that's when it began. That's what the prophecy is talking about, when the little horn, the Roman Catholic Church, began. This fourth beast would continue to be revived for over 1,500 years until the end 10th revival. Now, how frustrating for somebody who's watching the chessboard. The 10th revival is not going to come for 1,500 years. We want prophecy. We look at prophecy. We want to know what's going to happen at 8 o'clock tonight, what's going to happen tomorrow. I know a minister who was asked in a Bible study about a pope who had just been elected, and, you know, what's going to happen with this pope? And he said, look, this pope could die tonight. And he did. And the next morning, the minister's phone is just ringing off the hook. You know, what's going to happen next? Well, you know, that's what we want to know with prophecy. But it is frustrating the way God has written prophecy. He's written prophecies that cover thousands of years. And then, as we'll see, he's written prophecies that cover days. And it can be frustrating. But we just have to deal with what God has given. This leads to another unusual feature of the prophecy of this beast. The little horn of Daniel 7, verse 8, represents the powerful religious system. Verses 21 and 22 of this chapter, I was watching, and the same horn made war against the saints and prevailed against them until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was made in favor of the saints of the Most High, and the time came for the saints to possess the kingdom. So this little horn, this religion, is responsible for terrible persecution against the church. Yes, the church will be protected. You have to put all these prophecies together. But before protection, there will be persecution and martyrdom. And some will not be protected. Some will be allowed to be out there and be teachers, preachers, baptizers, guides, encouragers, whatever they will be. And some will be persecuted and martyred at the order of this little beast. It speaks pompous words, verse 25, against the Most High. It persecutes the saints of the Most High. How can it speak pompous words against the Most High? The Catholic Church claims it has the authority to change what God wants people to do. The Catholic Church, for example, admits openly that the reason why you keep Sunday is because the Catholic Church ordered it. Now, Protestant churches say, well, it's, you know, it's in the Bible here and it's in the Bible there, and it's not. It's not in the Bible. Nothing in the Bible that says you will keep Sunday. The day was never changed in the Bible from the seventh day to the first day of the week. The Catholic Church says our church fathers, our church leaders, our church authority has the authority to change God's words. Well, that's pompous words, changing what God has said. And they've changed holidays. Saint Valentine's Day is not a day we keep. It is a Catholic holiday. New Year's Day had to do with the Roman calendar. It is not a day that we, quote, keep. I mean, we take the day off. We don't go preach to people and say they're wrong, but we don't keep the days that the Catholic Church set because these are days against God. He will persecute the saints of the Most High. He will tend to change times and laws, as I've mentioned. And then the saints will be given into his hand for how long? Time, times, and half a time. And now here's this prophecy that gets extremely specific. It skipped thousands of years, dozens of centuries, and now it mentions time, times, and half a time. And you go through the commentaries and what's all this mean, and they all come down and they say it means 3 1/2 years. Time is 1 year, times is multiple, it means 2, and add them together, you get 3, and then half a time. And this, I won't take the time, no pun intended, to do it, but it compares with other end-time prophecies that mention it in different ways, so it's inescapable. I was talking with someone recently who said, well, you know, I think you take a day for a year, and that means 3,500 years, so you go back 3,500 years ago, and you see, I said, wait a minute. You cannot take every reference to a day in the Bible and say, apply the principle of a day for a year that's mentioned in Ezekiel, that's mentioned in Numbers, and say, that means so many years. You have to look at the context. And the biblical context, the broad context, makes this inescapable because the Bible mentions 40 and 2 months. And it mentions 1,260 days. And it mentions times, times, and half a time. And they all say it in different ways, so it's inescapable. It is 3 1/2 years. You cannot avoid that. So now this prophecy narrows down to 3 1/2 years. And that's when the main persecution will take place, just before and during that. There were Catholic inquisitions over the time of European history, but the Bible indicates that this little horn will come back and hold inquisition-like persecutions at the end of the age until Christ intervenes to save the saints. Verse 26, the court will be seized. They will take away the dominion of this beast and consume and destroy it forever. There will be no opposing religion in the world to come. And we have to tie these prophecies, Revelation 13, Daniel chapter 7, in with 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, which is about the man of sin, also called the false prophet. They're all about the same individual. And they're all about an end-time figure who could be that king sitting in Jerusalem who declares himself as God, who is attacked by a king of the south. 2 Thessalonians 2 adds to it. Now, the context of 2 Thessalonians shows that the individual spoken of is a religious figure. For a second time, Paul warns them about religious deception. He discusses it first in verse 5, which is manifest evidence of the righteous judgment of God, that you may be counted worthy of the kingdom of God, for which you also suffer. Verse 5 of chapter 2, do you not remember that when I was still with you that I told you these things? I warned you about the deception. In the verse before, what does this man do? He sits as God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. Very much like the language of Daniel chapter 11, verses 40 to 45. The time setting, just before the end. How do we know this? Because his end is when Christ returns. Verse 8, then the lawless one will be revealed. And to fill in the blanks there a little bit, the prophecy here says God essentially holds him back until it's time. Or we could say in the chessboard analogy, this piece is trembling and ready to move, and God doesn't allow it to move until it's time for it to move. And then God says, okay, and then this man comes on the world scene and he does what he's going to do. Then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will consume with the breath of his mouth and destroy with the brightness of his coming. So he is destroyed at the end of the age. The man of sin will be extremely arrogant. As I read verse 4, he opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God, just as it said in Daniel 7 about changing laws and times. He's a skillful deceiver. He's controlled and influenced by Satan. Satan gives him his power. What's it say in Revelation 13? Where does the beast get its power? Comes directly from the dragon, both of those beasts, the political government and the religious leader. How he will deceive people includes performing spectacular miracles, described here in 2 Thessalonians 2. That really takes people in. Could you be taken in by somebody who preaches Christ? And you should make no mistake about it. You should educate yourself sometime and read what the Catholic Church teaches and what the Catholic Church believes. They believe in being converted. They believe in being baptized. They believe in Jesus Christ, accepting Jesus Christ as Savior. They believe in many things that the Protestant churches believe. After all, they're the mother of the Protestant churches. If you come from a Protestant background, you may have grown up with this sense of prejudice that I grew up with, that the Catholics are just kind of as foreign to Christianity as Muslims are to Christianity. That's not true. Could you be taken in by a church that's preaching about Christ and talking about the Lord and talking about morality and is against same-sex marriages and seems to be down the line with many things that God's law supports, you know, except for the Sabbath. And then they perform these tremendous miracles. None say what it is. Cause fire down from heaven to burn something up or a building up or someone up or seemingly resurrect somebody or seemingly heal somebody. I don't know. But when Satan pours on the power, it will be tremendous, apparently. It's called, these miracles are called lying wonders. All power and signs in verse 9 that this man will be able to execute or have. The man of sin is part of the mystery of lawlessness, misleading people into unrighteous deception. His movement or his agenda will be to move people away from the law of God. That'll be the way that true Christians will be able to avoid being taken in and avoid being deceived. The scripture here talks about those who love the truth. Those who were deceived did not love the truth. That's right in the same verse here. Let's read it, verse 10. With all unrighteous deception this man works among those who perish because they did not receive the love of the truth that they might be saved. The truth includes the Ten Commandments and the Fourth Commandment and the festivals and the dietary laws. And we hang on to those laws, and no matter what miracles are shown, then we will not be deceived. Okay, I've already done the comparisons here that they do with Revelation 13 and Daniel and 2 Thessalonians 2, so we'll move along now to a subject called the abomination of desolation. Oh, now what in the world is this? The abomination of desolation. Daniel 11, again, mentions this. Now, abomination means detestable, disgusting. There were a group of women who danced with just body paint on and nothing else in Times Square here recently, and I would call that an abomination. Disgusting. Daniel 11, verse 31. Forces shall be mustered by him, and they will defile the sanctuary fortress, and they'll take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation. Now, historically, this is where this Antiochus Epiphanes that I keep mentioning comes in. He was, at the time, a representative of the Roman Empire, although later the empire disavowed him and actually sent people from the Roman government to attack him. It's a different subject. But he did go into the temple, desecrate it, and he offered pigs in sacrifice on the altar as a direct affront to the Israelis. Now, people say Jews, but to the people of Israel, I guess mainly they were Jews at the time. But obviously that would be an affront to God. And it was an abomination that desolated the temple. It was only after the Maccabean revolt under Judas Maccabeus that the temple was cleansed. And that, by the way, is the origin of Hanukkah, which is a different subject I won't get into. There's a second fulfillment of the abomination of desolation. Remember I say that prophecy is layered? The second fulfillment occurred in 70 A.D., the Roman armies destroyed the city of Jerusalem. Again, the temple and the altar were desecrated. This time, Luke 21, verse 20. You don't have to turn there. I'll just quote it and you can put it in your notes and look at it. It says, the armies surrounded Jerusalem. And that was the abomination of desolation. Why were the Roman armies detestable and disgusting? Because of what they were about to do. Because they were going to destroy this city, which had been the city of God, and the city which was the home of the temple. There is a third fulfillment of the abomination of desolation prophecy, as Jesus said in Matthew 24, verses 13 and 14. Matthew 24, verse 13, Jesus said, therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, spoken of by Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place. What's that mean? Who's the abomination of desolation? What is going to be disgusting and abominable to God? Well, Jesus said, parenthetically, whoever reads, let him understand. We don't understand yet. We don't know yet who this is on the chessboard. But he is on the chessboard, or it is on the chessboard, and it is an event that will take place at the end of the age. I'm skipping over things that I've already covered. Notice that in this case, I need to turn to this prophecy so that you get to see it. Daniel chapter 12, I'm not sure because the article here doesn't identify which chapter it is. Yes, okay. Daniel chapter 12, I'm looking to see where it talks about the abomination. Oh, here it is, verse 11. From the time that the daily sacrifice is taken away and the abomination of desolation is set up, there will be 1,290 days. What? Now, where does this come from? We've had thousands of years, then we've had 3.5 years, and now we have a specific mention of 1,290 days. There's also a mention of 1,335 days. And this drives people crazy. And they get out their charts and they figure out it's got to be this, it's got to be that, it's got to be the other thing. But God doesn't say. He just says on this chessboard is a time frame of 1,290 days and one of 1,335 days. And the 1,260 days are already mentioned. But what I want to emphasize here is that in the prophecy about what's going to happen at the end time, the sacrifices are going to be stopped. And the altar is taken away. Will there be a temple built before Christ returns? People say, well, yeah, the sacrifices are going to happen. No, not necessarily. All you need to have sacrifices is an altar. You can prove that from the Bible. Back in the time of Ezra, when Ezra led a group back from Babylon, they were afraid of the people around, but they wanted to immediately begin to honor God as quickly as they could, and they built an altar al fresco in the open air, and they began to offer sacrifices on that altar in the open air. That's all you need to have. Now, will there be a functioning priesthood? People say there are men trained to do these sacrifices. They're all standing in wait, and will the sacrifices go on for a period of months or years? We don't know. The sacrifices could go on for 2 months, for 2 weeks. The sacrifices could be done once, and then the authorities that bee would just simply squash them right there. But we do know that sacrifices will be offered before Christ returns, and they will be stopped. And that, in conjunction with something else, is part of the final fulfillment of the abomination of desolation. Now, fact check. Roman Catholic Church and Europe today. Is the Roman Catholic Church ready to dominate Europe? This is a report written in January 2014, and I won't pronounce the names of the people who wrote it because, to me, they're unpronounceable. Give a shot at it. Krotochvi and Dolizel. They wrote this detailed research analysis titled Politics and Religion in Europe, The Case of the Roman Catholic Church and the European Union. The executive summary says the main question explored in the article is the recent political interactions between the EU, European Union, and the RCC, the Roman Catholic Church. Our main conclusion is that the number and the intensity of the interactions have been continuously accelerating over the past 20 years. And say, oh, that's interesting. Well, what are the interactions that have been accelerating? And they go on to explain advocacy, lobbying, consultations, and networking. In other words, the Roman Catholic Church is a large political lobby in Europe. It is not a power that's dominating Europe. Additionally, reading from the report, there's much evidence to support the claim that the politics and religion in Europe influence of the Roman Catholic Church is limited. The most visible failures recently are, remember a few years ago, the EU came out with its constitution and the Roman Catholic Church said you must mention God in the beginning of the constitution because if for no other reason, Christianity has had so much to do with the history of Europe and the EU leaders would not do it. The Catholic Church did not have enough authority even to get that in. And now recently, the EU, you know, all of Europe is ahead of the United States in terms of allowing, say, immoral relationships. The Catholic Church has tried to use its influence to stop that. It cannot do it. Now, religion is on the rise in Europe, this report says. But most of the way that religion is on the rise is in a negative sense. It's talk about the influence of radical Muslims and the fear of attacks from religions that come into Europe. So that's the current picture. The Roman Catholic Church is a political lobby. It is not nearly a controlling power over the nations. And it could change, though. I'll give you just one possibility of how it could change. There could be so many attacks from radical Muslims that the church goes back to religion. Or there could be a massive attack that destroys Europe as we know it, and a pope rallies the Europeans to rebuild. Just a couple of ideas that could bring in the Catholic Church in the way that prophecy talks about, in a way that's on the chessboard. I don't know. One other factor that we have to look at in looking at prophecy is Jacob's trouble. It is prophesied that the modern descendants of Israel will go through trouble just before the rest of the world does. And that's where we come to the Great Tribulation, a time unlike anything ever in world history, according to Christ, Matthew 24, verses 21 and 22. Unless this time be stopped for the elect's sake, nobody would survive. Fact check. What is the strength of the United States today? What is the strength of China today? What is the state of the European army today? The world's most powerful economies, according to the London Telegraph, Friday, the 27th of November, says America has, and this is from a report analyzed in 2012. Okay, well, it's not like it's up to date up to 2012. America has secured its status as the world's most powerful economy, a position it is expected to hold for the next decade. And you say, how can that be? And emotionally, you respond probably the way I do. Well, wait a minute. There are 96, almost 100 million people unemployed in the United States, men, women who would work if they could. And the American economy is the most powerful in the world and will remain so for the next 10 years. On the basis of how things are now, that is true. These are the facts. So when you see the unemployment figures and you hear this or that projection, and you hear the political parties talking back and forth, we have to be careful. This gets back to one of the rules that I, or guidelines that I gave, not to overstate the case. The United States is not on the brink of collapse. Can that change? Absolutely. There could be terrorist attacks. There can be natural disasters. There can be an earthquake, volcanic attacks, tidal waves all at the same time and destroy the United States. But as it is right now, the United States is not the weakest economy or anywhere near the weakest economy in the world. China's number two, Japan number three, Germany is number four, France is number five, the United Kingdom six, Italy is eight, Russia is nine, India is 10. What about militarily? What's the most powerful military in the world? This is from Global Firepower, which simply relates the data that's available from the CIA and public databases to analyze the world's military. The most powerful military in the world is the United States of America. The second most powerful military is Russia. The third is China. The fifth is the United Kingdom. The sixth is France. Now, can that change? Absolutely. It can change. You know, things can happen that are unforeseen. But just so we know what the facts are, and when we're talking about things, that we don't overstate things, we need to know these things. What about the European army? Is there a European army? Yes, there is. The European Union has an army of 18 battle groups of 1,500 soldiers. At any given point in time, two battle groups of 1,500 men and women, 3,000 people, are able to go or be deployed. That means they have a total of 12,000 troops. That's the European army. However, they are pushing for having an army. They have been pushing for having an army for 60 years. The opponent who keeps them from having it is Britain, keeps voting it down. Now, if you took the armies of Britain and the armies of, let's leave Britain out of it because it doesn't want to be a part of it. You took the armies of Germany and France and Spain, and some of the lesser countries of the European 27 as they are now and combine them, the European Union spends only second to the United States on defense and military in the entire world. And it has second only to the United States the amount of nuclear weapons. But the problem is the European Union is red tape upon red tape upon red tape. You've got to go through papers and papers and papers and committee people and bureaucrats to get this and that. There is no centralized government in Europe. Europe cannot send an army into the Middle East as it now stands. Can that change? Yes. Under threat of its existence, the main core of what used to be the European Union can come together and form, 10 nations to become one. They could combine their military under a centralized command and control and coordinate their budgets and coordinate their efforts, and they could be extremely effective. But as they are now, the truth is they are mummified in red tape. That's how bad it is. The last lesson. Current events can and should be startling to us. It should be startling to read about and hear about the terrorist attacks like in France. It should give us a greater sense of urgency. It should motivate us. We're not surprised that these things happen, but they should motivate us. They confirm that we are within the parameters that God gave about Bible prophecy, but we have to be careful not to overstate them. We cannot interpret each event and say how much closer we are to the 1,290 days or 1,335 days. We don't know. Let me tell you the rest of the story about those two young men in the foothills of the Rocky Mountains. They never went any further than asking what will happen next in Bible prophecy. They never began to keep the Sabbath. They never were converted. They never became a part of the church. They never began to live God's way of life. They just wanted to know what's going to happen next in Bible prophecy. A great many of the older people in the church here will say that your first contact or the greatest motivating truth or booklet that you had was the United States and Britain in Prophecy. How many would say that? It was one of the hugest motivating books that you first read or truths. I would say that about myself. Well, we went through a time when the Worldwide Church of God was breaking up and leading up to its breakup when that truth was denigrated. It was humiliated. It was made fun of. It was mocked, as was Mr. Armstrong for his teaching. So in that environment, I took the 1967 edition. There are several editions. First one came out in 54, 56. And I only took the 67 edition because that's the one that I first got. And I went through it with a fine-tooth comb to analyze why did it grip me so. Because there are some questions about history, and there are some questions about the migration of nations and so on. There are some facts that maybe aren't entirely accurate. However, we are about to publish and release an extremely powerful booklet. It's unlike anything the church has produced before on the subject of the United States and Britain in prophecy, which has been researched and refined to the nth degree to get rid of these criticisms that people have had against it. But after all the refinements of going through this book, that I came up with why it had such an impact on me. There's three simple things that changed my life. There is a God. All the things that God said would happen in history and all the things that did show that there is a God. And number two, that God has expectations about how people will live. He talks about people opposing him. He talks about people keeping his laws. He expects people to live a certain way. And number three, he will call people into account for how they lived. That's what motivated me from that booklet. And that's frankly what should motivate us from prophecy. Guideline number five in answering the question, what's going to happen next in Bible prophecy, is it's important how we live. Not what we know. The core issue is how we live. Recognizing sin, repenting of it, praying, studying, fasting, serving, how we live. That's what's important. What's going to happen next in Bible prophecy? I could give you the same answer Mr. Armstrong gave in 1939. Here are the parameters. I gave them to you already. Same answer I gave the boys in Alberta in 1976. It's the same answer that we preach and publish today. God has given us the chessboard, but he hasn't named the pawns or the knights or the rooks or the bishops or the queens or even the kings of the north and the south. But he has told us how the match ends. Checkmate.